Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing good, Justin. How are you?
I'm okay.
Well, we do have some things to talk about at the beginning before we get into the episode. I want to start by saying, Justin and I would like to take a moment to acknowledge the passing of a wonderful woman, Carol Messner. She was a platform for those who needed support in her community. She never gave up. She touched the lives of many people. And she was very much into unsolved mysteries, anything true crime, and never said no to a bowl of popcorn. She will be missed.
And we have some birthdays too, right?
Well, there's definitely one. We want to give a shout out to Caitlin. So happy 36th, Caitlin. And thank you for the support.
And last, but definitely not least, if you're in Des Moines, Iowa on the 23rd, this is next Saturday, I will be at Zombie Burger from 3 to 5 and Black Sheep Speakeasy at 8 p.m. I'll be hanging out with Lauren from Paradise After Dark and Kelly from True Crime IRL. Come join us.
Yeah.
We have an update about the Zodiac case, which always sparks my interest because I still to this day wonder whether or not he actually exists and or committed all the crimes they say he committed. So what's going on with that?
Well, there's a cold case group. They claim that they've identified the actual identity of the Zodiac Killer.
They're called case breakers, yeah.
Everyone is now passing the story around saying that this is it. They found him. And it seems like one of the primary reasons they've identified this guy as the Zodiac is because of scars on his forehead that sort of remind them of the lines that are on the forehead in the sketch of the Zodiac Killer.
Yeah, I was looking at that. I couldn't even tell if there were scars or just wrinkles or what, but yeah.
That was my exact thought. Anyway, this guy named, we'll just call him Gary, because I'm not sure I feel comfortable naming him at this point, but yeah, this group says this is the Zodiac Killer. But I would say put the brakes on it for now. One thing I noticed when I went out to Twitter is all of the Zodiac Killer experts that are out there, the ones that live and breathe this case, they're all slamming this identification as bogus.
Well, I don't know if they've released all of their evidence or reasons why they're pointing the finger at him. But if it's just lines on a forehead, that's not enough. But if it's placing him at locations, especially if they have DNA or even the family DNA.
Familial. Well, I really believe they don't have any DNA to compare to the evidence. I didn't see anywhere in the articles that I've read where DNA is even brought up. If so, they wouldn't even be talking about lines on the forehead.
I would say.
They wouldn't be talking about the ciphers and taking the letters of Gary's name and removing them out of the ciphers and then saying the messages make sense.
Yeah. And let's say that this guy had committed one of the many murders that they claim were committed by the Zodiac. You have to show me how he's connected to every single one. Because again, there's that theory out there that a lot of these murders were random acts of violence that just got chained together. And that still could be a possibility. And just because we got one guy found guilty or one guy tied to one of those incidents, that doesn't mean a whole lot to me yet.
Yeah, I would say also there is a Riverside police officer, Ryan Railsback, who is already talking about this. And his quote is, if you read what the case breakers put out, it's all circumstantial evidence. It's not a whole lot. So you have the case breakers saying, we're going to share this with the police in Riverside. And it sounds like the police in Riverside are not impressed. But, you know, if you followed this case over the years, you know that many of the suspects kind of look like the sketch. So at least as we go forward, I would take this with a huge, we'll just call it a salt shaker, because this can't be the end of the story. I think if it was, the Riverside police would be much more interested. And so far, they seem to be unimpressed. And that's not to really diss this group. I think it's really interesting what they put together. So I'm not trying to poo-poo anyone working on this case. I think they should keep working it.
So Aaron, tonight's case, it's a brutal murder. And normally, we cover what people would call wrongful convictions. But this is the case where people call this a wrongful, not guilty verdict. I don't know what to call it.
This case took place December 31st, 1987. That's when Mary Fager, the mother in the family, walked into her home and she found the body of her husband on the floor and he had been shot to death. She turned around and called for help. Before we move on, I'd like to talk about this family because Philip and Mary Fager met because they both worked at Boeing. This was in the 1970s, and they were married in November of 1976. Kelly, their daughter, well, she came along with Mary, and they both had a daughter named Sherry, who was born in 1978. They lived in Wichita. What do you think when you think of Wichita, Justin?
I actually think of a soul coughing song called True Dreams of Wichita, but that's me. but I think the answer you were seeking was BTK.
Well, it's interesting you say that. We'll get around to it, right?
Yeah. A little foreshadow. Now, this family was very close. Philip and Mary were hard workers. They were fairly successful. They had a nice home, they had a hot tub, and they were adding on a sunroom to their house.
And to do that, they hired a man by the name of Bill Butterworth.
This sounds like a Twilight Zone episode with the names Butterworth and stuff. I just have to point that out.
Well, and this is a guy that was an Army veteran. He had lived in Wichita since 1978 and had worked as a foreman for a construction company in 82. So also in 82, he got married to a woman named Shelley. And it was just after that that he started working for Sunshine Rooms of Kansas. And this is how he ended up working at the Fager home.
Now, some of you might not remember, but there was a real estate bubble that popped back in the 80s, much like the one that happened in 2007, 2008. So there was a huge economic slump that was going on at this time.
Yeah, and that was affecting the business that Bill was a part of.
People didn't need add-ons to their homes. People didn't need sunrooms, right?
Oh, that's exactly right. So it starts to cut into Bill's business. And they said by August of 86, he couldn't even pay the rent on the storage building for his business. So he started working out of his home. And then he got into a contract dispute. So things were kind of tough back then. And he had kids to take care of as well. So at the end of 87, he's kind of back to work. That's when the Fagers hired him to build that sunroom. And here's the thing. They gave Bill the keys to their house so that he could come and go as he needed to, just to get this thing done.
I'm sure you've been here, Aaron. I've had some work done on my house where the workers, the contractors are coming and going so much that you leave the door unlocked for them because they got to get the work done and you want them to get it done faster so you can get back into your house and live your life.
Right. And it just seems like they must have trusted him, give him the keys. Now, Kelly Fager was 16 years old and she was dating a guy named Todd Morse. He was 20. Well, Kelly was really happy to tell him all about this hot tub. And Justin, let's move on though, because like I said, December 31st is the date in question. So on December 30th, Bill went to work in his Ford van. He left at 7 a.m. He always left at this time, it seemed like. So he goes off to the Fager's home.
Now he's there, at least his van is there most of the day. And he works through the morning and then claims that he's going to take a lunch break, right?
Right. Philip, well, he's out. He was going to one of his rental homes and Mary was out of town visiting relatives. So nothing significant there necessarily, but the next day, Mary Fager returned home. She got home about noon, and when she got inside the house, she found her husband dead on the floor. So she immediately left the house, called the police. One of the first policemen on the scene was Lieutenant Ken Landwehr. Now, if that name sounds familiar, it's because he worked the BTK case.
When police arrived, they found Philip face down. He'd been shot multiple times. And they also ended up finding the two daughters floating in the hot tub. It appears that they had been drowned. At the time that Mary had ran to the neighbor's house and had them call the police, she didn't know her daughters were dead. And she assumed that they hadn't been home and that they were okay. So it was really devastating for her when the police informed her that both of them were found at the house, deceased.
Detectives also found that the girls had been in the hot tub for most of a day. Kelly was disrobed and drowned. Sherry, the younger one, had been tied up with electrical tape and strangled with a cord and drowned.
One of the daughters is 16 years old, so I can't imagine she wouldn't put up a fight unless somebody had a gun to her.
They noticed that the Fager's vehicle was missing. They also learned that Bill Butterworth should have been at the house, but he was also missing. I have a feeling that Mary suspected Bill Butterworth might be connected to this crime.
Well, he was the only one outside of the family that was supposed to be there.
That's right.
And when he goes missing, well, he hasn't been murdered. His body isn't there. So it's an easy connection to make.
They're also trying to locate Bill's van. It's found that day at a McDonald's, which is where Kelly Fager worked.
After discovering his work van, they found that it couldn't shift out of first gear. There was something wrong with the gearbox. So not only is Butterworth having a lot of financial problems with his work and finding work, but it appears he can't even keep his work van up and functioning.
On January 3rd, Shelley Butterworth got a call from her husband, Bill, and she said, "The police are looking for you." Well, she's on the phone talking with him, and a relative who knows about this call phoned the Wichita Police Department and told them that Bill had made contact with Shelley. So they traced the call to Stuart, Florida. So that's quite a distance to go from Kansas all the way to Florida. That's a long trip.
It's a payphone outside of a motel, and they're able to get local law enforcement dispatched and over to that payphone while he's still on the phone with his wife.
Now, a lot is made of this, but I'm not really that surprised. Just imagine you're a married man and you take off and you're gone for several days and you finally make contact with your wife. You don't think she has a few questions for you? That could be a long call.
And she had actually reported him missing. No one had heard from him. So she was worried about him. She filed a missing persons report. So obviously she didn't know he was planning a trip to Florida.
So he's picked up by the Florida police, who inform him that he's a suspect in a murder case. But Bill says he doesn't know what they're talking about, and he seems confused. He doesn't even know why he's in Florida. That's what he claims.
As law enforcement does, they charge him with grand theft auto because he's caught with the Fager's car. Obviously, he didn't have permission to take it. So that's an easy arrest and charge to get him behind bars, and then they can work on the murder charges and more serious charges from there. That's just the way law enforcement works. I think it's kind of interesting.
Right. It only takes them a day before he's charged with three murders. And he was held in a Florida jail on a $500,000 bond. So it's that same day that he's being interviewed for about 4 hours. And they ask him the simple questions first, right? What were you doing at the home? Well, he was hired to build the sunroom for the family. And he claims that he only regained conscious awareness when he arrived in Florida.
Florida will do that to you. Wakes you up.
Yeah, it must be the sunshine or something. So they want him to go back and remember what he was doing the morning of December 30th. Because that's the day that these murders took place. And he says the next thing he remembered after that morning was hearing a news broadcast on the radio. And he said that's why he called his wife, because he'd heard about the murders on the radio. He knows who he worked for. So he's transported back to Wichita on January 8th, 1988. And, well, he needs an attorney, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, he's in big trouble here. What does it look like that most of the people that he was working for are now dead, and he has fled to Florida in their vehicle?
Let's just say that looks pretty bad.
His family can't afford a defense attorney, so they get a public defender named Richard Ney. Well, this guy is pretty new, pretty green.
He's full of zeal.
Yeah. And let's just say he's known to be a pretty good attorney as well. So it's a month later that Bill's talking to his attorney, and he's telling him, I want to see a psychologist because I really want to remember the things that I can't remember. I know that sounds funny, but that's what he's saying. So Ney gets a referral to Dr. Robert Pace, who's a hypnosis expert. And this is where things get interesting, because he has 20 sessions over the next 4 months, and he's hypnotized 10 times. We don't have any recordings of these. We don't have video. We don't have audio. But Dr. Pace took detailed notes. That's all we have.
Dr. Pace is sharing this information with the attorneys and whatnot. So I don't think Dr. Pace is trying to cover anything up. I think he's there to help. Bill is slowly remembering tidbits of what happened on that day. So over the course of the next few weeks, few months, Bill remembers going to work that morning, stopping for coffee, and he talked to Mr. Fager before he went to lunch. He left, ate lunch, and when he returned, Mr. Fager either left or put his car in the garage. He came in to work, but noticed somebody was in the hot tub, and he could smell chlorine. He didn't want to interrupt anybody. He felt uncomfortable, so he decided to leave until they were done, because the sunroom and the hot tub are in the same area. He says he goes to the mall and he looks at the Christmas sales, and he bought some clothes for himself. He remembers seeing some acquaintances at the mall, one of which was William Dotts, a retired police captain. He ends up leaving the mall at around 4:30, and he gets back to the Fager house, but there's no lights on, and he recalls seeing Fager's car in the driveway. He opened the sunroom door, and he found Sherry face up in the hot tub. He says he pulled her out and saw that she was dead. He went into the house and found Philip dead on the floor. He saw keys laying next to him, and he picked them up. He went to his van to leave, but the keys didn't work because he'd picked up Fager's car keys, and I guess in a panic, he's trying to leave in his van. He says he starts hitting his steering wheel and then realizes he has Philip's keys. He grabbed the bag of new clothes from his van, threw it in Fager's car, and he drove away. He says he doesn't recall finding Kelly, and it just, the whole incident was very upsetting, and he felt guilty and ashamed that he couldn't deal with that and he had to flee. Now, I don't think anyone could walk in and find multiple dead bodies in a house and react normally or take it in stride, but grabbing keys and jumping in their car and leaving, that's a little weird.
Well, that's where some people would say, how do you know how someone is supposed to react? He knows they're not his keys. I think that's clear even from the hypnosis session here. But I do find that weird.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out. Now, in his last session, he says he remembers entering the house to call for help after finding Sherry. He says he knelt beside Philip and tried to get him to move. He picked up the keys next to him and heard something, like a bump or somebody was in the house. And this scared him, and he thought that the killer must still be in the home. So he had to get out of there as soon as possible. After he leaves the home, what exactly does he do, Aaron?
So Bill remembered getting some money from an ATM, and then he drove past his house. He wanted to go home, but he decided to drive instead to Florida.
Does he know anyone in Florida? Does he have family in Florida? Why Florida?
Well, if you recall, he was asked why he was in Florida, and he didn't know.
Going from Wichita to Florida, that is a long drive, and it takes several days. He claims that he has very little memory of this, but he had the wherewithal to stop and empty his bank account, which there wasn't that much money in it anyway. So, and
have cash on hand so he could make it to Florida, buying gas and ultimately trying to book a room at a hotel, all in cash.
So with that said, is it any wonder that the police thought, we don't have to look any further. Mr. Butterworth makes for a damn good suspect.
Yeah. I mean, if the mom, the wife, had an affair on the side, her daughters would not be the target. If one of the daughters had a boyfriend who was abusive or something, why was everyone in the household wiped out? And why would you even consider those options if you have a whole family wiped out and there's a guy fleeing the scene in their car? I understand why the police wouldn't explore other options here or other avenues of suspects, because there aren't any.
So at that point, all we know is Dr. Pace had worked with Bill for a while. They stopped working together in terms of having these sessions, because at one point the court decided, you know, if you two are going to keep having these sessions, you're going to have to start turning them into the state, which I think means they would have to record them. And Bill decided, I think that's it for now. He said he would consider resuming sessions if he got past this trial. He's the only guy that the police have set their sights on. So he knows this is a sure thing. He's going to court. And let's just be clear, he's maintaining that because of these sessions, he knows for sure that he didn't kill the Fagers.
He is essentially telling the same story. He's just adding more details to it over and over again. So by the time they get to trial, he hasn't exactly contradicted himself. But because all of these details were from hypnosis, that's got to be hashed out, right? I mean, we got to determine what's admissible and what isn't. And this is the first time that testimony of the accused is going to be used under hypnosis in a court of law.
What will the court say? This is important because if the court rules that this is inadmissible, then Mr. Butterworth doesn't have much of a defense, does he? This is a way for him to explain what he saw and heard. And if he can't explain it, then that just makes him look more guilty. This account that he gives through the hypnosis is very much, I didn't do this. I found the bodies and I panicked and I left. So he's basically saying, I got into like a foggy state and was out of my mind for a little bit because of the fear. And I just needed to get away.
I wake up in a foggy state every day. Just give me a couple hours. I'll make it work. But this has got to be a whole hearing where they determine whether or not his testimony, his statements can be used. And Dr. Pace testifies at that hearing that Bill was suppressing his memories because of the trauma he experienced. And he wasn't suppressing them because he had done something, but it was so traumatic for him to come across two dead bodies. Now, of course, the prosecution is going to argue that hypnosis-aided testimony is not the best, and it would be the first time that Kansas had ever allowed it.
Butterworth's attorney told the judge, look, we're not going to bring Dr. Pace in to testify. We're not even going to show any session notes. We just want to be able to have Bill testify about what he recalled. He called it a constitutional right. So the judge actually said, okay, we'll postpone things for a little bit, but we do want the doctor to turn all of his notes in. We want to at least have that in the court. So in the end, it was decided that Bill would be able to give his testimony based on what he recalled during hypnosis. So this is a huge point of contention, is this claim that Bill Butterworth essentially had amnesia, you know, that he lost his memory of what happened, of what was going on for a while until he had the hypnosis. So there's a psychologist brought in for the prosecution who testified that most times that defendants are claiming amnesia, they're just faking it. But then, of course, he's asked, well, how do you know if Bill is telling the truth or not under hypnosis? So it becomes this question during the trial. And of course, the psychologist is trying to say that he didn't think that this crime scene was traumatic enough to cause Bill to black out like that. to not remember.
We don't know what's going to traumatize somebody. We don't know how bad a crime scene needs to be before it shocks someone. But at the same time, amnesia.
There were questions raised about Dr. Pace, and these will come up later again after trial. But the prosecution was quick to point out that Dr. Pace didn't exactly follow proper guidelines because, well, for one, he didn't record these sessions. And two, he asked leading questions. One of the things that he had told Bill was, you will recover your memory. And apparently that's against procedure.
I take way more of an issue that they weren't recorded, whether it be video or audio, over him telling him, you're going to recover your memories. I don't. That's like the least of my issues with the way this was all performed.
Yeah, and I'm right there with you. I think this just doesn't make sense to me. The ability to record it is there. They just didn't do it.
If I was accused of murder, I wouldn't want my sessions recorded either.
It's on May 27th of 1988 when the prosecution goes over what physical evidence there is. But, you know, they bring on five different police officers, and it doesn't seem like there's any evidence tying Bill to the crimes. So they go over it and they say, you know, was any semen found on the girls' bodies that's tied to Bill? You know, any fiber evidence, fingerprints, you name it. And there's just nothing there.
DNA won't be a thing until later, but yeah, no physical evidence.
They said they found fibers from Philip's coat on a towel that could have been used to muffle a gunshot, but no firearm was found. All they know is that Philip was shot with a .38 caliber handgun.
Now they know the Fagers didn't own a gun, so this weapon had to have been brought by the perpetrator and disposed of or taken by the perpetrator of the crime.
And another question would be, did Bill carry a gun?
Well, it's said that he did own a gun, but they could never recover it. Prosecution, they also present evidence that Bill was stalking the daughter, Kelly, during her shifts at McDonald's. They're going to have two witnesses say that they saw the van there in the fall of 1986. Now, in 1986, Bill was not working for the Fagers. So the prosecution's argument there is a little shaky because you would assume that he was hired by the Fagers and therefore he met the daughter and then started stalking her.
I mean, there is that possibility that he could have stalked the daughter, Kelly, before he was hired.
Possible, but I would just assume that how did he get hired? Like, it just seems very convenient.
Yeah, that's what we don't know. Would Kelly have spoken to her father or mother about this and said, please don't hire this guy, he's been stalking me? Or did she even know who he was? She just knew she was being stalked. So a lot of questions there. Another strong point for the defense is that there is no motive for Bill Butterworth to murder the Fagers.
Yeah, because the only motive that has even been pointed out was the stalking of the daughter. But as you know, that allegation was before he was working for the family. So was that a misstep of the prosecution? It's a question. Now, Bill had financial issues, but he didn't rob the Fagers if he had done this. He didn't steal tons of money from them. So the motive is pretty much non-existent for Mr. Butterworth.
This is the prosecution's theory. Between noon and 1 p.m., the killer drowned Kelly and left her body in the hot tub. The killer then tied up Sherry with electrical tape and used a cord to choke her, but that didn't kill her, so he then drowned her in the hot tub. Now, the prosecution believes that the bodies may have been put in at different times into the hot tub because there was about a four-hour discrepancy between the two bodies based on their condition. Then the lid was put over the hot tub. Philip arrived home sometime around 1 p.m., And that's when the killer snuck up behind him and shot him twice. They also laid out that there were various neighbors who were in and out of their homes who noticed that the van was there throughout the day. So that's another thing they're tying together is that was he really gone much of the day? Because to hear Bill tell it, he had a really long lunch. And then, you know, basically Bill says he doesn't get back to the Fager home until much later in the afternoon. There is a neighbor named Jonathan Pollock who is apparently very helpful with police, stating the times that he saw the van outside the home. I will say that he said at 8:30 in the evening, that's when he noticed that both the van and the car were gone. They also know that Kelly's boyfriend, Todd Morse, was supposed to call Kelly that afternoon. And he called at 3:30 and at 7 o'clock. Because he couldn't get a hold of her, he just figured, well, I'll just stay home. But that's the prosecution's case. So really, all the prosecution is doing is saying, this is a very simple answer here. Bill Butterworth was the only one outside of the family that was there. He was known to be there. He was working at that home. After these people are murdered, he takes off in the Fager vehicle and heads to Florida. Doesn't even tell his wife where he's going. They're very confident. Some say they're too confident because they just believe this is easy. How do you not figure this guy did it?
But the defense, they do have things to counter the prosecution, such as when Butterworth went to the mall, they have a receipt, they have the clothes he bought, they do find the people he spoke to and question them, and they verify that he was there. They also point out that there's no physical evidence tying him to the crime. They point out that Butterworth has stuck to his statement this entire time. Now, that statement was gathered over months through hypnosis, but they claim that he's never deviated from it.
Now, how do you feel about all that, Justin? Because I am not swayed by the receipt or the people he talked to, because I think it's quite possible he could commit these murders and do all that.
I agree. I think he could have done those things before and then gone to the mall or done them after, because it wasn't until the next day, right, that Mary came home?
That's right. And I'd also say that no physical evidence is expected in this case, because Philip was shot twice. So if you don't have a murder weapon, then what evidence is there? What are you going to gain by testing these bullets that went into his body? What are you going to gain by trying to do forensics on these two girls that were in the hot tub? They're in a hot tub for about a day.
Chlorine is bleach. It destroys everything. So there isn't going to be any evidence tying him to it. And even if they did find his fingerprints there, he's been working there. He's been building a sunroom. So it wouldn't be outlandish that his fingerprints could be found at least near the scene of the crime.
And Nate was saying, there's no motive here for Bill to kill this family. But he goes further. On May 28th, he tries to present an argument that the Fagers may have been killed by BTK.
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, BTK would murder families.
And this is Wichita. This is his hunting ground. Yeah.
But the judge refused to admit a letter from BTK to Mary Fager. But Nay is trying to say, hey, BTK was the killer. All you have to do is read this letter.
That letter is kind of interesting, Aaron. What does it actually say? I believe that it truly is a letter from Dennis Rader. But what did he write to Mary?
That's, you know, depending on what you read, there are different things posted about this letter. As far as I could tell, it was basically just a comment on one of the girls being put into the hot tub and a drawing of that hot tub with the girl in it. But apparently, based on the drawing, most people think that shows that Dennis Rader had no knowledge of what happened there.
There's tons of articles out there that say the letter said, I didn't murder your family.
Yeah. And I think that's in dispute. But either way, at the time, they didn't have BTK, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, BTK wasn't caught until 2004, I think.
When he reared his ugly head again.
Right. And one of the detectives on this case is one who ended up catching BTK, and we've covered that case before. I don't think the letter proves anything. All I could say is I think Nate did the right thing by bringing up BTK, because I don't think he was resting on the "you have no proof." I think he wanted to also provide another suspect to the jury.
Yeah.
And say, look, we have a serial killer out there somewhere, and you may not have heard from him for a few days or months or years or whatever, but this is something he could have done, and we believe it's him. But the judge has every right to admit or refuse evidence or any kind of theory from an attorney, and that's what happens in this case. So the defense isn't resting here, though. They also want to admit reports from social services that says that the girls were afraid of Philip. That was also denied. So then the defense attorney moves on to Sherry's boyfriend, Todd Morris, and he brings up this theory that Todd Morris and a friend of his who works at McDonald's should be suspects. Now, I find this interesting because, you know, Nay is saying, look at BTK, then what about the father? And now what about Todd Morris and his friend?
Well, the best defense is a good offense, and pointing the finger at other suspects, that can bring in reasonable doubt.
Yeah, but it also gives me reasonable doubt about his really believing these people are suspects, because he really seemed to think BTK was the killer, but then he's also throwing Todd and his friend in here and trying to place some blame at Philip's feet. So it seems like he's throwing a lot of spaghetti at the wall at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
But the judge is saying no, no, no to all these things. These are just suspicions. Another note, though, there was snow on the ground that day in question, but there were no footprints outside the house showing someone coming and going. We've heard of this before.
Yeah.
It's nothing new, but you would think if there was snow on the ground that they might see something, but yeah, they didn't have any footprints to go off of.
Well, I mean, if the person's coming and going from the front door to the driveway or the garage to the driveway, what are we going to have? I can't say it points to Butterworth or not, because if the perpetrators were using the same path to enter and leave the house, then it's not going to stand out at all.
So closing arguments happened on June 6th, and then the jury deliberated. This deliberation took, well, less than a day.
Yeah. As you can tell, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. There's a lot of suspicious behavior. There's common sense. But is there enough to convict Mr. Butterworth for this crime? The jury acquits him, comes back with a not guilty verdict. Now, that may or may not be a surprise to some if you caught my hint at the beginning of the episode, but this was a surprise to everyone in that courtroom. It was a surprise to most people in Wichita. It was a surprise to the Fager family.
Richard Ney made some comments after the trial, which I think highlight why the jury acquitted William Butterworth. And this is what he said. I wish I could say that I was a brilliant attorney who got a killer off, but all I did was show that Bill was innocent. I don't think you always have to prove the why of a case, but with Bill, you had a guy who never did anything wrong, was trying to raise his children, working on a home construction job, one of hundreds he did, and suddenly he kills an entire family? So he's just pointing out there's no prior behavior that can be proven that Butterworth would do something like this. That's his point. There's nothing proving that he participated or perpetrated these crimes. So moving on from there, he's basically saying, what do you have? You have a guy who stole a car, and you're going to pin murders on him because he stole a car.
In the court of law, that's what they have. And that's what they brought to a jury. Now, we can all sit here and say, well, we know what really happened. But when you're sitting in that jury box, when you're in that deliberation room, you have to know beyond a reasonable doubt. And this jury couldn't say beyond a reasonable doubt that this man committed these murders. Now, we can sit back and argue, well, what really happened then if he didn't do it, and not be able to come up with a better explanation. But just because we don't have a better explanation doesn't prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think when it comes to the courtroom and juries, I can't say that this jury got it wrong. I don't know if any jury really gets it wrong. Juries decide based on what's presented in a court of law. And as we have said many, many times in the past, you know, the prosecutor can say, you know, he flew in on a pig and killed this person and flew away. And if that's not objected to, then the jury has to deliberate on that. And in this case, maybe it was the decade, maybe it was because it was the 80s, maybe it was because of the weird hypnosis testimony, but this prosecution, they just didn't bring the claws out. They just presented what happened that day and just figured the jury's smart enough, they'll figure it out. That's not good enough, is it, Aaron?
Well, and I think when you have Bill explaining what he remembers due to hypnosis, it really puts him in a different position. He's able then to put himself in the position of an observer, not a participant. So now he's seeing these things, right? But, you know, I think about that, and I think about how he described not seeing Kelly. You know, at one point he's asked by the psychologist, you know, do you think that noise that you heard that scared you, is it possible that that was Kelly? And he says, yes. So I agree with you. I think if you're on the jury and you're being told there is no evidence tying this person to the crime and the prosecution didn't really sway you, like you feel like the defense did a good job defending their client, then how are you supposed to find this person guilty? And I can tell you that the jury foreman paid a dear price for being the jury foreman, because there were a lot of people in Wichita who were very, very angry with this verdict. That lead detective, Landwehr, he believed they had the right person. He believes Butterworth did this, and he was very disappointed. There have been comments since that maybe the prosecution just, they didn't take this seriously enough. They were just too confident.
The police department closed the case. That's how confident they were. And they're not planning on reopening it because they're like, we got the right guy. The jury's the one that got it wrong, not us.
They feel like they have nowhere else to go with this case. I mean, it's one thing for people to say, eh, we got the right guy. No, this one, they really feel like there's nowhere else to go with it.
Because again, the only other angles I think they could take would be the mother was the perpetrator or a boyfriend of one of the daughters. Throw BTK out the window because that doesn't work for me. But there's nothing there. And the boyfriend, I mean, the van being found at the McDonald's, that points more to Butterworth than a boyfriend at McDonald's. Just that's a box in Butterworth's list, not a boyfriend list.
This was a difficult vehicle to drive. And some have said that really only Bill could drive that vehicle. He's the only one who could really start it up because it was so jacked up. I mean, when they found that van, the keys were still in the ignition.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
So there's a lot of talk about why this went the way it did. I think we covered why we think it went the way it did. But I do want to say, this is the kind of case where usually I feel like when you don't have evidence to tie someone to a case, you don't have a case. But here, I really like the testimony from the witnesses who lived on that street. And if you go by what they're saying, the van was there most of the day. I don't think the van would be seen there most of the day if he had been gone so long to this long lunch. That doesn't make any sense. Do I think he left the house and went shopping? Yes. Do I think he talked to people? Yes. Those people aren't lying. But if you ask me, I think the answer, the motive here, is that he got into it with Philip. He doesn't have his gun anymore. I think something happened. And, well, once you kill somebody, then you have to take care of any other witnesses there are. So do I think the prosecution laid out a very good case when they talked about who died and when? No, I don't think so. And that's why, you know, this result doesn't bother me as much because, you know, that's your chance. You don't get to just get the benefit of the doubt because the prosecution has to get their case right. And in this trial, no, they missed so much. And I think about just the vehicles. Did they even really test those vehicles? I don't feel like they did.
I think they could have nailed down a time frame of when he was at the mall, but they didn't.
And if you have someone firing a gun, there's going to be gunshot residue. How hard did they work to find gunshot residue anywhere else? I feel like that was overlooked. Just imagine if they had tested those vehicles for gunshot residue. Might have explained some things. So in the end, do I think Butterworth did it? I think he makes for the best suspect. And I fully believe the police did the right thing by focusing on him. But I think they failed to create a motive, a why in this case. I think that hurt them. And everything fell behind that. All the defense really had to do is point out the flaws in the case. And they did that. So they essentially won by not losing, in my opinion. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.